Chapter 6, The Final Work, 1835 to 1844. Mary Shelley's final novels may not appear similar, but they share a dual priority, one that she had been advocating for since Valperga, the cause of peace and the rights of women. To her, these ideals were deeply intertwined, as in her earlier works, the female characters are the ones who speak on behalf of balance, love, and harmony. However, where both Catherine Gordon and Euthanasia fail to stop men from waging war, in the last two novels, Lodore and Faulkner, the female protagonists, Fanny Durham and Elizabeth Raby, both triumph over the impulses of the male characters and succeed in creating communities based on family and egalitarian ideals. In these final novels, women are valued for their strength, independence, and education, and men are valued for their ability to adapt to these new standards. Lodore, 1835. Mary Shelley sent Lodore during her own time, the 1830s. The novel revisits the ideas of her earlier work, extending and developing these themes in a contemporary setting. As in all of her previous novels, she explores the impact of masculine ambition on the lives of women, but this time, she also grapples directly with the problem of female education, denouncing the shallowness of aristocratic English society. In setting the book in her own time period, Mary Shelley exposes issues that were relevant to her readers and to English society as a whole. Now that she was the most distinguished female writer in England, she did not need to hide her reformist agenda and could elevate her radical beliefs. Accordingly, the salvation for the female characters can only begin when Lodore, the title character, dies and the women join forces. Lodore is a ne'er-do-well man about town, self-indulgent, poorly educated, and selfish. He fathers a child in an adulterous affair, and then marries 16-year-old Cornelia, a lovely girl, somewhat ignorant. She is depicted as shallow and dedicated to pleasure and amusement. When she gives birth to a child, Ethel, she ignores her. Lodore, on the other hand, adores Ethel. Too much, Mary Shelley implies, and to escape fighting a duel with his son from the adulterous affair, emigrates to America, where he isolates Ethel from her neighbors, showering her with incessant care, and rendering her completely dependent on him. Like Matilda, Ethel inspired him with more than a father's fondness, and she in turn seldom thought and never acted for herself. When Lodore dies at the end of the first volume, his death creates a hole in the plot, undercutting the reader's expectations that a novel must revolve around a central male character. Who will step into Lodore's shoes? In Mary Shelley's hands, it is the female characters who fill the void. For once Lodore is gone, the women can now take center stage. The male characters are so weak that the women must save one another from harm and find happiness without any hope of rescue from a man. Even Edward Villier, Ethel's love interest, cannot help her out of her predicaments. In the world of Lodore, as in all of Mary Shelley's novels, there are no heroes. At the age of 16, Ethel is released from her father's oppressive love and is able to move forward, establishing a positive relationship with her mother and a friendship with another young woman, Fanny Durham, an intellectual who has educated herself according to Wollstonecraft's principles. Ultimately, it is Fanny who becomes a guide for Ethel, exemplifying the values of independence and integrity. That Mary Shelley named her heroine Fanny is a poignant tribute to her sister. In the world of the novel, Fanny lives the life Mary Shelley wished her own Fanny could have had. Self-sufficient, free of the strictures of husband and father, and supported by her female friends, Fanny Durham lives with admirable rectitude. She dedicates herself to improving the world, educating herself, helping and advising her friends, and working toward reforming society, embodying the Wollstonecraft axiom, provide women with education and freedom, and the world will be a better place for everyone. At the novel's end, Fanny and Ethel joined together to create the peaceful, sentimental community that Mary Shelley had first dreamed of in 1814. By advancing her mother's ideas and asserting the benefits of independence for women, Lodore became Mary Shelley's most overtly radical book to date. She displaced the male aristocrat, Lodore, with his direct opposite, Fanny Durham, an intellectual, middle-class woman who is independent and reads philosophy, dedicating herself to cultivating her own genius and that of others. As the novel's modern editor, Lisa Vargo, writes, the book is an imagined conversation with Mary Shelley's mother, a life-writing practice that allows her to speak to and through her mother's beliefs. Without a historical setting or dystopian world to screen the reader from her reformist agenda, it was, perhaps, a surprise to Mary Shelley when Lodore was published in 1835. The reviews were more positive than those for her other books. As had happened earlier, this was because many critics misunderstood the work, describing it as a romance and overlooking its message of reform. Viewing the book as a domestic novel of manners, they praised Mary Shelley for her exploration of the secrets of the human heart and neglected its politics, particularly the elevation of Fanny and the establishment of the peaceful community at the end. Perhaps because of this oversight, the novel sold briskly. Aubrey Beauclerk. Mary Shelley had spent the years after Percy's death mourning his loss, but as an attractive young widow, she had her share of suitors. In the spring of 1832, at the age of 34, she drew the attention of a handsome young radical, 31-year-old Aubrey Beauclerk, who admired her for precisely those things that scandalized other members of English society: her writing, her politics, and her outrageous past. Aubrey courted Mary Shelley, making efforts to talk to her when they met at parties and other social gatherings. But it was not always easy to get to know her. Although she could be warm and funny with her friends, Mary Shelley tended to be quiet in the company of strangers. Those who met her for the first time were often taken aback to find that the author of the notorious Frankenstein was so reserved. One new friend described his astonishment at finding her gentle, feminine, ladylike. Another confessed that he had thought she would be indiscreet and even extravagant, but was agreeably surprised to find her cool, quiet, feminine. These responses reveal the stereotypes that dominated the period. People assumed that artists and writers who wrote bold, imaginative works would themselves be bold and masculine, making it difficult for Mary Shelley's contemporaries to reconcile the ambitious qualities of her work with her identity as a woman, and a quiet one at that. But as an up-and-coming politician, Aubrey needed a wife who would help him advance his career. He ended the affair and married a rich young woman, free from debt and scandal. For Mary Shelley, this was a terrible loss. In Aubrey, she thought she had found another Percy. He had been ardent and loving, and held the same political views. He fought for the abolition of slavery, supported the Irish cause, and was one of the most energetic advocates of the reform bill that was debated in Parliament in the spring of 1833. In the wake of this loss, writing Lodore became a cathartic exercise. As she worked on developing the character of Fanny Durham, Mary Shelley deepened her commitment to her mother's ideals. Like Fanny, she decided, she did not need a man. What she needed were her books, her writing, her friends, and her philosophy. She would continue to advocate for a more egalitarian society, for educational reform and social justice, but she would do so as an independent woman, an unattached, self-sufficient Fanny Durham. Biographies. While Mary Shelley was in the midst of writing Lodore, Dionysius Lardner, a friend of her father, invited her to compose biographical essays for the Cabinet Cyclopedia. This was a signal honor, since Lardner had his pick of contributors and intended to reach a wide audience. Also, he paid well. The assignment he gave her was to write essays on the literary men of Italy, Spain, Portugal, and France. She was one of the few writers he knew who had the requisite language skills, erudition, and talent to take on this challenge. Pleased to be recognized for her abilities, Mary Shelley gladly accepted Lardner's offer, becoming the only female contributor in a literary group that included luminaries such as Sir Walter Scott. She began work in November 1833. At the same time, she was working on Lador and continuing to write short stories, but she had never shied away from hard work. For the next 4.5 years, she researched and wrote more than 50 portraits of the most eminent literary and scientific men of Italy, Spain, Portugal, and France, finishing in May 1838. For many years, historians have underestimated how many of these articles she wrote, as Lardner did not always identify the authors. However, the modern consensus is that Mary Shelley wrote at least 3/4 of the 1,757-page project. She relied largely on her own translations, and the results are among her best literary efforts. Her criticisms are cogent and illuminating. She set the lives in historical and political context, and chose vivid examples to demonstrate the strengths and weaknesses of the author's work. Her scholarship was impeccable. "My life and reason have been saved by these lives," she wrote on 2 December 1834. The partial anonymity of the articles, not all were signed, and then usually just with initials, allowed her to express her opinions without fear of repercussions. In addition, writing biography released her from some of the limitations of writing fiction. Instead of having to advance a plot, she could include her own observations, views, and political philosophy, and even parts of her own story, just as she had in 6 weeks, albeit refracted through the lens of the great men's lives. Always committed to revealing the experiences of women, she spent hours reading about the lives of the mothers, wives, daughters, and sisters of her subjects. Loyal sisters, female friends, wives, mistresses, and widows fill the pages of her essays. After the first stages of research, she became so engaged in these women's lives that she, once again, proposed a volume on historical female figures, but this time to Lardner, not Murray. When Lardner refused, she resorted to amplifying the lives of the women in the biographies, advocating for the inclusion of at least a few women writers, including Madame de Stael and her old friend, Isabella Baxter's heroine, Madame Roland, in the section on French writers, and drawing lines of connection between the historical figures and the present. For example, in her portrait of Montaigne, she included several paragraphs about his friend, Marie du Gournay-Lujat, who edited his work after he died and was esteemed one of the most learned and excellent ladies of the day. And, she adds wryly, was honored by the abuse of pedants, who attacked her personal appearance and her age, in revenge for her transcending even their sex in accomplishments and understanding. Not only did Mary Shelley's work on these biographies help her forget Aubrey, they gave her a renewed purpose as a writer. Even if she could not dedicate her essays entirely to the lives of women, as she wished, she could still celebrate the triumphs of these historical women. She could praise their courage and their principles. She could also empathize with the many challenges that they faced. Godwin's death. In 1836, the year after Lador was published, her 80-year-old father died. The funeral was a macabre affair. In his will, Godwin had written that he wanted to be buried as near his first wife as possible. And so Mary Shelley, her stepmother, and 16-year-old Percy Florence watched as the gravediggers shoveled the dirt out of Wollstonecraft's grave. "Her coffin was found uninjured," wrote Mary Shelley, and everyone stared down in the hole where they could see the cloth still over it, and the plate tarnished but legible. It was the closest she had come to her mother since she was a few days old, and now her father was gone too. Before he died, Godwin had asked his daughter to write his biography and edit his unfinished works for publication. Mary Shelley began dutifully enough, but soon became paralyzed by the enormous scale of the task. Godwin had kept a copy of almost every letter he had ever written, and had taken voluminous notes on all his reading. There were piles of manuscripts, old drafts of many of his books, and an unpublished book critiquing organized religion. Despite the difficulty of the project, she worked on it steadily for almost 4 years before stopping, exhausted at the sheer effort involved. Her own work was suffering. She knew that a biography of her father would not sell well, and that his diatribe against religion would harm, not help, his reputation. And so she gave up, sure that, once again, she had disappointed her father. But she had reached the limits of her strength. Faulkner, 1837. Although Mary Shelley could not write Godwin's biography, she still had the energy to write one more novel. The year after her father died, when she was 40, she finished Faulkner. She thought this book was her best, but this assessment is difficult for modern readers to share, as the dialogue is stiff and the characters are somewhat two-dimensional. But Mary Shelley did not judge her books for their realistic qualities. She cared about politics, philosophy, and human rights, and judged her books, and all books for that matter, on their ethical standards. If one adheres to these criteria, then Mary Shelley is right. Faulkner is her best work, as it is in this novel that she gives full voice to many of her most radical ideas, and the female characters enjoy their greatest triumphs. Elizabeth, the heroine of Faulkner, shares the same name as Frankenstein's bride, but she has far more independence and strength than the Elizabeth of either the 1818 or 1831 version. In Frankenstein, Mary Shelley had created a helpless victim, a symbol of feminine dependence and passivity. In the 1831 edition, she had also created a racialized Elizabeth who serves as a foil to the creature. In Faulkner, this new, improved Elizabeth is neither racialized nor weak. She conquers her enemies and redeems the men in her life, saving them from failure and disastrous fates. At the end of the novel, she helps establish the most fully realized of Mary Shelley's sentimental communities. Elizabeth is only 6 years old when she first meets John Rupert Faulkner. They encounter each other in a graveyard, not unlike the graveyard where Mary Shelley and Percy first consummated their love, and where Wollstonecraft and Godwin were buried. Faulkner is about to commit suicide, but the child Elizabeth saves him by crying out, distracting him from his purpose, and demonstrating her ability to take charge of an unstable situation and save an adult from himself. Elizabeth is an orphan, and so Faulkner adopts her, grooming her to be as dependent on him as Ethel was on Lodore, and as the 1831 Elizabeth was on the Frankenstein family. But Elizabeth has already shown herself to be far stronger than either of Frankenstein's Elizabeths, far more independent than Ethel, and wiser than the self-destructive Faulkner. Accordingly, she resists his attempts to make her dependent on him, devoting herself to her studies with the help of her governess, a Wollstonecraft figure. When she is 13, Faulkner, like Byron and Raymond in The Last Man, goes off to fight for Greek independence, leaving Elizabeth alone at home to continue reading philosophy and literature. Like Mary Shelley's other great heroines, Euthanasia and Fanny Durham, and like Mary Shelley herself, she continues her rigorous schedule of study, reading the great works of classical philosophy and English literature, and building up her reserves of self-reliance and independence. When Faulkner is wounded, she travels to Greece to rescue him, demonstrating a reliance on her own powers that others admire. and also demonstrating a heroic ability to succeed where the ostensible heroes, Faulkner, Byron, and Raymond, have all failed. Unlike these men, not only does she survive the battlefield, but she rescues her father, reversing the roles of daughter and parent by committing a trespass of the highest order. Like Catherine Gordon and Euthanasia, she ventures onto the battlefield, leaving the private sphere and entering the world of men, going against everything a woman was supposed to do. Thanks to her courage, self-discipline, and the support of her Wollstonecraft-like governess, Elizabeth has learned to subvert the rules that bind young women of the era, refusing to become a timid, homebred young lady. With each new challenge, she revolts against frivolous rules and resists fictitious notions of propriety and false delicacy. When Faulkner is falsely accused of murder, she advocates for him, yet again saving his life while also demonstrating her independence, as others scorn her for defending a criminal. She seeks a bold and dangerous freedom, having been educated beyond the narrow paling of boarding school ideas or the refinement of a lady's boudoir. Ultimately, she becomes braver, bolder, and more successful than any of Mary Shelley's previous heroines. She is also far more heroic than any of Mary Shelley's male characters, or, for that matter, any of the men whom Mary Shelley knew in her own life. At the end of the novel, Elizabeth marries Faulkner's enemy, the man who accused him of murder. To do so, she must overcome Faulkner's resistance to her love affair. But she does this with aplomb, reconciling the two men and connecting them as part of a loving family, creating yet another one of Mary Shelley's sentimental communities. Faulkner, like Lador, and Matilda's father, has tried to control his daughter, but Elizabeth overcomes his authoritarian impulses as education has given her independence and the ability to think for herself. Driven by her love of truth, she, like Fanny Durham, is able to defy the hypocrisies of her world and convert others to a more philosophical way of life. In testimony to her influence, Faulkner no longer seeks to be a hero, but delights in his new capacity for tender feelings and the gentleness in his soul that he now experiences. Like Lionel in The Last Man, he acknowledges his transformation in gendered terms, declaring that his man's heart has become tender, his heart soft as a woman's. Faulkner's celebration of his new softness reveals how Mary Shelley has turned 19th-century values upside down. In her novels, softness is more of a virtue than hardness, a tender heart more virtuous than a ruthless one. An irony, since as a well-trained classicist, she knew that virtue came from the Latin word for man, vir. Although Faulkner received some favorable reviews, critics focused on it as a love story, overlooking the contemporary issues that Mary Shelley raised. Once again, she had used fiction to subvert and critique the values of her time. And once again, this critique went largely unnoticed. For example, when Faulkner is imprisoned, she provided a disquisition on the injustice of the legal system. She also included commentary on the evils of class prejudice, the problems with educational institutions, for both men and women, and even the racist policies of the British government toward India. Instead of creating male characters who save the women in their lives, she created a female character who saves her father and her lover. Instead of painting war as a glorious and heroic endeavor, she demonstrated the sufferings it caused. In her hands, domestic life is transformed from being simply the province of women, a place of dull mediocrity, to the locus of community, the place where people can find fellow feeling with the oppressed. Indeed, this is perhaps the most radical point of all. In the world of Faulkner, the domestic sphere is no longer the private sphere of womanhood, but is instead a shared public space of harmony and virtue. Sales of Faulkner were slow, and Mary Shelley, who is in the midst of writing the section on Spanish and Portuguese writers for Lardner, which she finished that summer, decided that Faulkner would be her last novel. Her work as a fiction writer had come full circle. In Frankenstein, Victor's ambition destroys everyone he loves. Innocent people are killed, their houses burned. Margaret Saville Walton does rescue her brother, but her presence is off stage and her voice heard only indirectly. Furthermore, Walton's rescue is overshadowed by the destruction caused by Victor and his creature. In Faulkner, Mary Shelley creates a heroine who can save the male characters from ruin, preserving their lives, freeing them from destruction, and bringing them into the peace and warmth of a community. These were the goals of Euthanasia and Catherine Gordon, but they could not prevent the men in their lives from seeking after false glory. Acting as an advocate for peace, Elizabeth creates a utopian community in which men and women alike share the bounties of their life together. Without the follies generated by male ambition, Mary Shelley argues that there would be no more war and no more children lost. It was a fitting place for this reform-minded, radical writer to end her career as a novelist, but it was also a fitting place for Mary Shelley, a 40-year-old woman, to finish. Whether she was aware of it or not, in fiction, she had at last recouped her losses and redeemed the suffering she had endured with Percy. In her final novel, the heroine succeeds where she, Mary Shelley, had failed. Elizabeth Raby stops the men she loves from pursuing their follies, persuading them to live with her in harmony and peace, the kind of harmony that Mary Shelley had yearned for her entire life. Percy's Complete Works. In the summer of 1838, just before Mary Shelley turned 41, the distinguished publisher, Edward Moxon, offered her £500 to edit a 4-volume set of Percy's collected poetry and prose. Moxon had published Tennyson's work and was enthusiastic about Percy's posthumous poems. He wanted Mary Shelley to overturn Sir Timothy's prohibition and compile all of Percy's work into a complete edition. He also asked her to provide a biographical background for those readers who had already encountered Percy's poems and wanted to know more about him. This was an opportunity to establish Percy's literary legacy that Mary Shelley did not want to miss. She had dreamed of bringing his work into the world since Percy had died, but she doubted that Sir Timothy would allow the project to move forward. However, the matter had become urgent, as, over the last few years, several pirated copies of Percy's poems had been published, and Mary Shelley was disturbed by the many errors. She wanted to correct these mistakes and bring out a well-edited, comprehensive edition of his work. Fortunately, Sir Timothy had a new young lawyer who admired Percy's poetry and persuaded Sir Timothy to give his permission. Sir Timothy agreed, but he drew the line at a biography. He did not want the old scandals brought back into the public's memory. It had taken 16 years to rehabilitate the Shelley name. Although Sir Timothy did not give her credit for this, Mary Shelley's preface to Posthumous Poems had helped, but so also had the passage of time. Frustrated though she was that Sir Timothy would not let her write her husband's life, Mary Shelley was pleased to have the chance to publish Percy's essays and poetry, and she devised a strategy that would allow her to include biographical matter without Sir Timothy noticing. She would write notes, setting Percy's writing in context, but also telling the reader details about his life. She knew this was breaking the rules, but she had learned to think strategically after all these years, and so she did it under the guise of an editor, not a biographer. However, she had not realized how painful it would be to revisit the past. When she reread the old diaries and papers, she had to relive all the sorrows of that time, the loss of little Clara, Wilmouse, Fanny, and Byron. There were also happier memories, Geneva, the early years in England, the first year in Italy, but even these were difficult to bear. Most disheartening of all, though, was once again facing the pain they had caused Percy's first wife, Harriet. In her diary, Mary Shelley wrote, "Poor Harriet, to whose sad fate I attribute so many of my own heavy sorrows as the atonement claimed by fate." Then there was the problem of the controversial work. Some of the poems promoted radical politics. Some were dedicated to other women, and she was not sure how to handle this information. Should she reveal his affairs, risking Percy's reputation? After much thought, she decided to guard their privacy. A veteran of scandals, she knew that if readers knew too much, they would be outraged and discount the genius of his work. When Wollstonecraft had died, Godwin's tell-all memoir had so scandalized the public that Wollstonecraft's books went out of print, and those who had once admired her turned their backs on her, trying to distance themselves from her sexual escapades. Mary Shelley was not going to do this to Percy. She wanted to create a literary legacy for him, not divulge the scandals of their personal life, and so she decided the most honorable thing to do would be to tell the reader that she was leaving out some events. She would share stories that would help them understand his work, but she would withhold others. "This is not the time to relate the truth," she wrote in the preface, "and I should reject any coloring of the truth." With this gesture, she made two points clear. There were secrets, and she was not going to reveal these secrets, not because she did not want to, but because it was the wrong time, an aspersion against the prejudices of the era. However, Mary Shelley did allow herself to relate vivid tales about their life together, describing where Percy wrote his poems and what else was happening in their lives at the time. She captures him reading on his boat and remembers how he marveled at fireflies. She depicts his excitement when he saw the bird that would inspire his famous poem to a skylark. She emphasizes Percy's lyricism and the purity of his convictions, how little he sought worldly fame or money, how passionately he loved his art. Mary Shelley knew that if she wanted the public to admire her husband as a poet, she must avoid mentioning his radical ideas. She was also well aware that any controversy surrounding his name would hurt her career as well. Both of their literary legacies depended on how carefully she retold the past. The first volume took her almost a year, during which time she became ill. In her journal, she wrote, "I am torn to pieces by memory." When the reviews came, the critics praised Percy, but criticized Mary Shelley. The Spectator and the Athenaeum thought her editing was awkward and that she had left too much out. The Examiner disagreed with her assessments of Percy's work. Trelawney, intent on publishing his own memoirs and seeing an opportunity to hurt Mary Shelley and advance his own career, joined the chorus of critics. Complaining that she was too deferential to Sir Timothy, he called her a coward, claiming that all she cared about was her allowance from the Shelley estate. Trelawney's criticisms hurt, but Mary Shelley ignored them. She wanted people to read Percy's work. She needed to protect Percy Florence. She also needed to continue to earn money to support her family. But she did decide to respond to the remarks from the literary journals, revising the first volume to include Percy's more radical essays and poems. However, as she predicted, there was a swift reaction from conservatives. These readers sued Moxon for blasphemy, the last case of its kind in England. The conservatives lost the case. The book stayed in print. But the experience took a toll on Mary Shelley, reminding her of what she stood to lose. Worried about what the public would say about his other, even more inflammatory work, she spent the rest of the year working on the prose volumes. She did not want to mutilate Percy's ideas, she wrote to her friend Leigh Hunt, and yet she knew some of his ideas were too outrageous for readers to handle. Wisely, she did not publish those letters to her father, in which Percy extols the principles of free love and argues on behalf of their illicit relationship. She also left out passages that were overtly atheistic. But when one friend suggested that she delete the homosexual references in Percy's translation of Plato's Symposium, she took a stand, saying it was important to keep as many of Shelley's own words as possible. Laboring to make the choices that were best for her husband's legacy, she finished in 1840, exhausted and discouraged, writing in her diary that she felt as though she could never write another word. In the preface, she apologized for any weaknesses, never realizing that her edition of Shelley's complete works would be one of the great achievements of her life. She had single-handedly brought him into the public arena, praising his poetry when few people had heard of him. Experienced fiction writer that she was, she knew how to depict Percy as a figure who would appeal to the public. She went even further than she had in 1824 in posthumous poems, telling readers that he dwelt in a higher sphere, like an angel, that he was an exalted being, and pure-minded, completing her transformation of the atheistic, anti-authoritarian Percy into a Victorian martyr who died for the cause of liberty and virtue. To the modern reader, Mary Shelley's portrait of Percy may seem untruthful at worst, and incomplete at best, but she had only expunged what she felt the public could not understand. To her, what was most important was his work, not the details of his life. She believed she had captured what was most important about Percy, his commitment to art and philosophy, which was, to her, the epitome of virtue. If she had told the whole truth about their life together, 19th-century readers would never have read his work, and it might have been lost forever. A sellout, Trelawney complained, but Mary Shelley was a veteran of the literary marketplace. She knew what her audience would like and what they would hate. Complete Works was a sensation. New readers praised his lyrical genius. The old scandals faded away. Before long, Percy was celebrated as one of the great English poets, having gone from being a renegade to Christian-hearted, from being a scandal-ridden cad to a literary star. Mary Shelley had done her job so skillfully that no one bothered to dig below the surface. In part, this was due to the fact that she had become a master of invisibility, leaving behind only traces of her presence. Like Margaret Walton Saville, or the editor of The Last Man, or Valperga, she fades into the background, never revealing the effort she has poured into recreating his work. Instead, she lets him take center stage, as though he is one of her literary creations, like Lionel Verney, or one of her female heroines, Fanny Durham, or Elizabeth Raby. When pressed, Mary Shelley declared that she was fortunate to have lived with such a noble soul whose dedication to love and purity was truly remarkable. She was nothing next to him, she declared, and so, in the end, she created another character, one of the most long-lasting of all her creations, a fictional Mary Shelley, a Victorian wife and humble scribe. Like Victor Frankenstein's creature, this Mary Shelley was the invention of a master novelist and was as different from the actual Mary Shelley as Shelley the poet was from the real Percy. As she worked on promoting Percy's reputation, her own fame continued to grow. In the winter of 1839, her friend Richard Rothwell painted her portrait for the Royal Academy, figure 8. In the painting, she wears a low-cut black dress. Her hair is tidy and her face pale. She looks beautiful, melancholy, and worn down, as indeed she was, too weary to hide her sadness from the artist. Rambles in Germany and Italy in 1840, 1842, and 1843. 1844. Despite her exhaustion, at the age of 42, Mary Shelley decided that the time had finally come to return to Europe. After years of living frugally, she had saved enough money for this trip, and she, Percy Florence, and one of his Cambridge friends set forth for Italy in June 1840, visiting many of the old sites. She enjoyed herself so much that 2 years later, they returned to Europe, this time to spend more time in Venice and Rome. Her joy at these returns was tinged with sorrow. She tried to find the graves of Clara and William, but they were unmarked. She also visited Percy's grave in the Protestant cemetery in Rome. When they returned to England, after their last trip abroad, Mary Shelley organized the notes she had taken, and by January 1844, had finished the first volume of what would be her last work, a travel book she titled Rambles in Germany and Italy. Like her first book, 6 Weeks, and indeed all of her books, Rambles was a tribute for her mother, but it was also a fitting end to her own career. As in 6 Weeks, she praises the sublime qualities of nature and delves into politics, exposing the evils of Austria's occupation of Italy. She analyzes the art she sees, revealing her acuity as a critic, and also refers to ideas from the Symposium that she had once helped Percy translate. Artists should not be vilified for depicting scenes of homosexual love, she wrote, a stance that could have earned her a sharp rebuke if any of the critics had noticed it. But once again, reviewers overlooked her critical theories and her politics. No one noted her endorsement of homosexuality, her erudition, or her observations on art. Some reviewers enjoyed the charm of the narrative, and a few did applaud her anti-Austrian stance, as this was a popular foreign policy. But Mary Shelley was not unduly cast down. For her, there was nothing new about being misunderstood. Even if the reviewers didn't realize it, she knew she had triumphed in the end. An independent and self-sufficient woman, she had published all of her books under her own name, filling them with her own thoughts and ideas, her radical politics, and her cultural criticism, a long journey from 1817, when she had been dependent on her lover to support her, had published her first books anonymously, and endured social exile for being an unmarried mother. Now, she was an author who had successfully raised a son and supported friends and family for most of her adult life. Final years. In 1844, Sir Timothy died, giving Mary Shelley and her son their first taste of financial security. At long last, the Shelley ancestral home in Sussex belonged to 23-year-old Percy Florence. Mary Shelley was relieved, but she had begun to feel ill during their travels in Italy and grew steadily worse over the next few years. She worried about Percy, hoping to see him happily married before she died. One of her concerns was that he would choose the wrong person, someone who would take advantage of his trusting nature. Fortunately, in 1848, he married a young woman named Jane, who was sensible, loyal, and, best of all, devoted to her mother-in-law. For the next 3 years, Mary Shelley lived with the young couple, growing weaker until she died on 1 February 1851, at the age of 53. In the last month of her life, she lost the power to speak, and her left leg was paralyzed. The final diagnosis was a brain tumor. Jane and Percy Florence were at her bedside when her sweet, gentle spirit passed away, as Jane later recalled in a letter to her friend, Alexander Barry, on 7 March, 1851. Percy was devastated. He had always lived with his mother, except for his years at university. Together, they had carved out a life, filled with beauty, contentment, and good friends. Now he felt lost, without a center. Fortunately, Jane helped him heal, encouraging him to follow his favorite pastimes, sailing and amateur theater. In the years after her mother-in-law's death, Jane swept into action, taking steps that still appall biographers and historians. She wanted Mary Shelley to be seen as a pious, grieving widow, not as a rebellious young woman who lived with a man out of wedlock and had 3 illegitimate children. To cover up her mother-in-law's history, she went through Mary Shelley's papers, burning letters, and ripping pages out of diaries. She also wrote her own untruthful version of Mary and Percy's courtship in a book she entitled Shelley Memorials. Published in 1859, this volume was designed to clear the family of all scandals. Declaring that Mary Shelley had told her the real story of her relationship with Percy, Jane wrote that the young lovers had only confessed their feelings after Harriet had died. She also said that it was Percy who initiated their love affair, not Mary Shelley. Jane's efforts were so successful that it took over a century for the truth to reemerge. Just as Mary Shelley had created an angelic personage, the ideal Victorian poet, in place of the real Percy Shelley, so Jane created a selfless wife and daughter, an ideal Victorian woman, in place of the impassioned 16-year-old, the outrageous daughter of Wollstonecraft, who declared her love for a married man and ran away with him to Paris. Mary Shelley's self-deprecation, her portrait of herself as nothing more than a devoted wife, and her silence about their life together in the volume she published of Percy's work, supported these portraits, as did the obituaries that came out after her death. Jane and Percy Florence moved from Field Place to Bournemouth on the south coast of England, buying a large estate called Boscombe Manor. Here, Jane promoted the image of Mary Shelley as the docile wife of the great poet, building a shrine to her mother-in-law. Figure 9. She draped a corner of her drawing room in red velvet and painted the ceiling blue with yellow dots for stars. She hung the Rothwell portrait of Mary Shelley on the wall behind a row of glass-covered cases that contained precious items, such as Mary Shelley's hand mirror and Mary Wollstonecraft's amethyst ring. The pièce de résistance was an urn containing the remains of Percy's heart, which his son had found a year after Mary Shelley died. He had been too grief-stricken to unlock his mother's writing desk immediately after her death. But when at last he did, he discovered her journal, a folded copy of one of Percy's poems, Adonais, and inside the paper, the dusty remains of his father's heart. Generally speaking, Victorian society embraced this image of Mary Shelley as a paragon of virtue, but the vindictive Trelawney capitalized on this false portrait of Mary Shelley to further his claims that she was a hypocrite, painting the Shelley's marriage as a disaster in his self-promoting account of Percy Shelley's life, Records of Shelley, Byron, and the Author. For over a century, Mary Shelley, the woman who had begun her public life as a renegade and a rule-breaker, would be known as a pious wife or a hypocrite, depending on the point of view of the writer. She would be condemned for many contradictory failings, compromising the radical views of her husband or failing him with her mediocre views. Gradually, people forgot that she was the daughter of the famous radical Mary Wollstonecraft. If people knew her at all, it was as the author of Frankenstein, and many doubted that she wrote even that, as some held that Percy must have been the author. However, her last public act demonstrated her commitment to women's independence and her mother's values, invisible though it was to the outside world. A few months before Mary Shelley died, Isabella Baxter Booth, her old friend from Scotland, wrote to ask if Mary Shelley would petition the Royal Literary Fund for assistance on her behalf. Mary Shelley had not heard from Isabella in years, as Isabella's husband, David Booth, had not allowed Isabella to be in touch with her friend after Mary Shelley ran away with Percy. But now, having nursed her writer husband through a long illness, Isabella was penniless and desperate. Despite the rupture in their friendship that had left her heartbroken, Mary Shelley, near death, hardly able to pen a legible word, knew what it was like to have no money. She wrote to the fund on 15 November, 1850, connecting Isabella's plight to the sufferings of all women. Her husband's malady demanded a care and courage in nursing, she wrote, which for a woman to undertake and go through alone demanded heroic exertion. Heroic exertion. These words resonate, in part, because they are the last she ever wrote, but also because they could be said of Mary Shelley herself. Like Isabella, it had taken heroic exertion to overcome the challenges she faced. She had written 9 books, more than 50 stories, articles, and biographical sketches, supporting herself and those who depended on her in a world that condemned her for the choices she had made as a 16-year-old girl, and also condemned her mother. The fund rejected her petition, but Mary Shelley did not want Isabella to suffer, and, in her will, asked Percy to send her old friend an allowance of £50 a year, a symbol of her dedication to improving the lives of women. In her novels, essays, and stories, and in her quiet, behind-the-scenes actions, Mary Shelley had made the plight of women the driving force of her life. And yet, this truth was almost lost to history. It is only now, with access to her journals, letters, and diaries, as well as the important critical studies of the last few decades, that she is recognized for her courage and her creativity, her authorial innovations and her struggles. To the end of her days, she tried to live by the words of her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, seeking to reform the world by vindicating the rights of women. Figure 10. This concludes Mary Shelley by Charlotte Gordon, narrated by Susie Alphens. Copyright 2022 by Charlotte Gordon. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Oxford University Press and was produced in the year 2022 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright there too. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.